Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com. I was trying to think of like where we could start today. And I thought a really cool place to just go right into it would be to kind of talk through the process that you went through going and getting approval to manage a lifestyle hotel with Marriott. And for like those listening, it's very difficult to manage a lifestyle hotel with Marriott. They only go to a few select management companies. We're lucky enough to be approved. But I think at the time you were doing that, you were under construction of one of your hotels in Tennessee, and you were currently managing a Holiday Inn Express. But I thought that would be like a really cool way to jump into the conversation, talking about how that ability came about to convert to a Marriott lifestyle hotel.
Absolutely. I think that's an accomplishment that we're very proud of. And I would say it took many years to really get up to that point. So when I joined the business about 8 years ago, every property was run different. When I joined, we had really economy, select service brands. And one property was owned by my father, one by my mother, one by my uncle, and everything was done miles apart at each hotel. So when I was in DC for grad school, my brother was in Boston, our brains got rewired from the mom and pop operating shop to more structured. So when we came back and joined the business, our first point of focus was the management. Many people will go and build the portfolio, but for us, it was very important to first build the infrastructure for it, and then the portfolio will come. So we got approved at this point, but probably 2.5, 3 years ago for being a lifestyle operator or a full service operator at Marriott. But really the journey for that started 5 years before that. So we first set out to build our home office or corporate office and go foundation by foundation. So accounting, revenue management, HR, sales, marketing, we spent a couple years putting systems in place, standard operating procedures, bringing the right team in place, and going through the motions of that with our prior portfolio. So when we made the venture to contact Marriott about a lifestyle product in the market, they came out and they loved the market. It was hot post-COVID, and our locations were A+. And when they came out, we had some great concepts that we wanted to put in front of them. And I think they were all in. The caveat was, at that point, we couldn't manage it. And, you know, we understood. We had no primary experience. From what I understand, most full-service operators had 10, 12 select-service hotels before they got a shot at it. But for us, we really wanted to control our own destiny. And we said, hey, Marriott, give us a shot. Give us one chance to show you that we can do it. And if we fail, we fail. We'll consider bringing a third-party operator. So they gave us the shot. And Marriott came in and picked us apart. So whether that's accounting, revenue management, operations, getting into the technology, going through SOPs, really down and dirty into every part of our business. And about 2 weeks later, I get a call from the development team and said we got approved, and they don't know how we did it. But I boiled it down to about 5 minutes, but it took about 5 years of work to be able to get to that point and have our first Marriott be a full service lifestyle property.
And what hotel was this? And what phase in the development of the hotel did this all go down?
So we got approved for the Scoundrel. So the Scoundrel is a new construction in downtown Gatlinburg, directly across from the convention center. I mean, you can't find a better site. So that was going to be a new construction. After we got approved, we had another repositioning that we were doing in Pigeon Forge. Pigeon Forge is known for the land of Dolly Parton, Dollywood, and the island. And we had this old Days Inn across from the island. So when you talk about the best location in Pigeon Forge, you can't get better than this. And we'd had it for about 10 years, the asset, and it was time for some major upgrades. So we knew what we wanted to do, but not exactly how we wanted to do it. And in looking for some ideas, I went out to California, toward Malibu, LA, Palm Springs areas, and we found this Palm Springs Oasis concept. And I think exterior corridor motels turning into high-end boutique hotels was a trend that I'd been seeing, and we wanted to do it in this market. So we'd probably gone halfway through design and met with Marriott and talked about the idea of a tribute portfolio on this old Days Inn. And at first, they laughed about it. But after we had showed them the presentation, the branding, the deck, the design, and kind of walked it with them, they saw the concept and the vision. And there were some other properties that had done very successful out on the West Coast, and we wanted to bring this to the East Coast. So we were halfway through. I think we had broken ground and then brought Marriott in on the treatment portfolio. And today, that's the way back. So our second product deal that we signed with them is actually the first that got opened. And that's what we're managing today.
All right. There's a lot to unpack here. I'm going to go first back to the kind of difference between a mom and pop family enterprise type of business versus maybe what you wanted to try and create, which is a little bit more institutional, a little bit more third party, a little bit more Marriott. What was like the big differences between mom and pop style and where you are today? And then also tell us what is better and worse about each. There's got to be some good things about mom and pop that are better than the other way. So
there are so many good things about the mom and pop way. And I know so many great operators out there that started the mom and pop way. So my first home was literally in a motel for about 28 years. So everywhere we went, there was the front desk of a one or two story motel. Behind it was the back office. Through the back office, there was a little door that went into our living room. Then there's a kitchen and then bedrooms. So everywhere we went, on the backside, we'd tear out 4 units, and that was our home. And we did that for 28 years. My brother's in the business with me. He's a co-founder of the company. And he gravitated towards the front of the house. I gravitated towards the back of the house. So every day I was with my father in laundry, maintenance, grounds, and loved it. So we really learned the business from the bottom up. I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. What I really wanted to do was be a general contractor. So I studied supply chain in undergrad and then went out to work for a GC after college. I didn't know what I was getting into. It was this boutique general contractor out in East Tennessee. And the job they happened to put me on was at this little place called the Blackberry Farm. And I know you were just there recently, and the Blackberry Farm is this magical Houlin Chateau resort on thousands of acres in East Tennessee. And prior to that, Jake, honestly, when we travel, we'd stay at a mid-scale economy property. If we were lucky, and that's my lucky day, we'd be at a Hampton Inn or a Courtyard or something big back then. And always loved them, but that's not what excited me or got me out of bed. Blackberry Farm is what made me want to get out of bed. So within 2 months, I was in hotel grad school in DC, got a job there, and I had the mom and pop operating knowledge, knew how to run the property myself. But while I was in grad school, I really wanted to get a more structured knowledge of operations. So I, during the evening times, or it's when my classes were, during the daytime, I picked up a job at Westin, which was managed by HEI Hotels back then. And that's where I got the ins and outs of how a professional management company runs the business. Fast forward, when I moved back home, I took a job with Margaritaville in operations and did that for about a year. And at that point, I had a good understanding of what made them successful, or at least I thought I had a good understanding of what made them successful, and then joined the business. And they'd been asking us to join for a couple of years. And when it came to the right time, it was really, are we ready to change and blend the old school with the new school? We can't forget the old school. It was the foundation. Everything we know today, we refer back to, but it's more of a new way of doing business and staying true to our roots and heritage.
What would be like a kind of a glaring story or a little anecdote you can share with all of us about the clash between the old school and the new school and your implementation of what you've learned from other folks on the new school side?
So it was an adventure. I think first we had to kind of grease the wheels a little bit and get people comfortable with the idea of the change. And I think the family said they were ready for the change. It took a lot of work to actually make that come to reality. Fun stories. I mean, moving into this office that we're in today, we're in downtown Sevierville in an old bank building that we've been growing into. It was a tough pill to swallow to be able to manage the hotel with not being able to see the front desk or going out from room 205, which was the old office, to what's the maintenance man doing? What's the housekeeper doing? Vendor relations. How could we keep up with accounting out of a software, not out of a shoebox, for multiple hotels if we weren't at the hotels? So a lot of pain. We moved into the office, but I think for the first year, we were still on property every day. So we had to kind of give, but also show where we wanted to be. And bringing in professional management helped as well. My father was a GM. He was always the maintenance guy. When we need to be the housekeeping, we do the housekeeping as well. So bringing in GMs, building the structure within the company, training, bringing in staff, I think over time, it helped us be able to show how we can effectively manage a portfolio in a professional way, but still be high touch. So we say this often, we are high tech, but we're also high touch. Our hotels are in our backyard. Without traffic, I can be any one of our hotels within 20 minutes. I would say someone from our home office team is at a hotel every 2 to 3 days, checking in with our GMs, making sure they have the tools and resources, training that they need to be able to do their jobs effectively. So I don't think we have or we will ever lose the high touch for our hotels. And I think that's how we keep everything together. Yeah.
There's a consistent theme that I've seen from a lot of people that either come into hospitality in like two ways. One, they have a very similar story to yours where they basically like lived in a hotel and they know the manager of the business cold. And the other way is where they have like no hospitality experience at all, but they like design or they like building and creating unique spaces. And I think that's probably more prevalent post-COVID because everyone wants to own like a cool little motel or a cute kind of Airbnb cottage on the beach kind of thing or a cabin in the woods. What do you think most people underestimate about hospitality before they actually get in and start running the business and opening the hotel?
I think people underestimate how complex a well-oiled machine can be for a hotel. I think in today's day and age, especially with branded, there's so much technology. I mean, you know, a technology stack at a hotel, PMS,
yep.
POS, booking engines, accounting systems, integrations, and then what it takes to run a lifestyle hotel from a home office support level and what qualified, capable management needs to know to be able to operate those. It's not as easy as I think a lot of people may think. And I think even for us, we'd been in the business for 20 plus years and that we could make the change quickly because we'd been in grad school and seen how it was done in DC and Boston. It wasn't the case. I mean, being able to get into the nitty gritty, getting into the weeds, showing that vision and that culture and living it every day takes a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. But I think the design side is much easier than the operational side of the business. And the operational side of the business is probably less sexy to a lot of people, but I think that's where the battles are won, is the operational side. You can design a great space and a great hotel, but without a proper backbone, it's just going to be an empty body.
Airbnb has created a ton of people getting into hospitality. I don't know if I want to call it hospitality, but certainly vacation rental. And it's enabled people to kind of create a portfolio of like 10 cabins in the hill country in Texas or 20 cabins by a beach. And the whole model is based upon no service, very DIY, check in online, services remote in the Philippines or in South America. I want to get your point of view on that strategy in the kind of lifestyle hotel ecosystem and how you think that plays out. And if you think that is actually a sustainable model versus what you're doing at some of your properties like the Wayback.
Can you go a bit deeper into that question, Jake?
Yeah, there's a lot of people that are focusing on designing a lifestyle hotel, but they're basically providing zero service, zero amenities, and everything is kind of digital DIY check-in versus everyone in hospitality on the lifestyle side. It's still very high touch, as you like to say. Is there a long-term business strategy for like the low touch model? Or do you think it all comes back to more of the high touch lifestyle experiential side?
I think there's a model for the low touch side. I think there are times when someone is wanting to go on vacation and just unplug and be in a cabin in the woods and not hear from anyone. But I think many times people are looking for that connection with the hotel staff. There's a lot that just can't be done in that no-touch model. F&B is one of them. I haven't experienced a great F&B outfit in any of these low-touch models. When it comes to service, I think that has to be something
I want to transition a little bit to the way back and how you figured out that you could convert what was like a motel into a lifestyle hotel. Because personally, I think there's a huge investment opportunity in that space. There's a lot of existing hotels in great locations that don't look great anymore. Talk to us about like how that idea came about and how you got the process off the ground.
Yeah. So, I mean, we knew the property had great bones. It had great location, great visibility. The question was, what can we do with it? And how much is it going to take based on what our business plan is going to be? So we easily could have upped it and turned it, upbranded it to a select service mid-scale brand. The location is directly across from this place in Pigeon Forge called The Island. It's 300,000 square feet of indoor, outdoor restaurants, amusement, and some very high-end hotels in the area. We really want to be able to capitalize on that, and we just didn't see a mid-scale opportunity as the best use. We thought about tearing the building down and then building new, but we really wanted to be able to do something unique in the area, the region, make it a destination. So when I was out in LA, a friend of mine said, go check out Malibu, look up Palm Springs. And I think within a half day, I knew where I wanted to take the property. So I came back, pitched it to our stakeholders. They liked the idea. They liked the initial budget. And I got to work with that. So we really brought in great design teams. I mean, we probably interviewed over 30 design firms for the project and really found the ones that could do the concept the way I had envisioned it. I think at that time, there weren't that many that had done the exterior models as there are today. So we wanted to focus on Southeast. So we had great architect, great interior design team, branding team, and really kind of set the vision to bring it to life. So the design process was every bit of a year. After we signed the franchise agreement, things changed. So we had to make some changes to that.
What kind of changes did you have to make once you signed the agreement?
The biggest one was fire life safety. And that was a big one. So we had, the building had no sprinkler, no fire alarm. The doors weren't secure. Elevator needed complete overhauls. So a lot of those infrastructure related issues that the building had to get upgraded, which added well over seven figures to the budget within 30 seconds of signing an agreement. But I think looking back, I think the guest sees it, feels it, helped their insurance costs, and looking back, I don't think we would have done it a different way. I think to really be able to stand out and stand apart, those things are critical to the overall hotel. And Marriott's ideas around the pool experience helped as well to really help it stand out as well.
What were you looking for in an interior designer? I don't think I've ever heard of anyone interviewing 30 designers. So I'd love to know how you narrowed down your choice.
30, if we were to do it again today, it wouldn't be 30. It would be less than that. For me, it was a big learning experience. That was my first boutique lifestyle property. I wanted to do it right. But I also, going back to that initial budget that I talked about, I need to find someone that could fit the budget. And I went over and over and yep. over and over. I'm like, why is everyone $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 for a motel? I mean, design is expensive. We ended up spending around that time too, but it took me about 30 designers to get to the point where, hey, maybe this is going to cost me three times what I had budgeted for the design. So in that, we focused on who could do what we were looking for the vision, not necessarily have the best portfolio of as our hotels around the country. So we found a firm that had done phenomenal new construction, had done renovations, and done some exterior as well. They're based out of Nashville, and we had a phenomenal experience working with them.
What was important for you on the interior design, and how did you run that process? Like, were you very specific, showing like mood boards and all this kind of stuff? Or did you just really kind of state the vision and let them run with it? How does that work for you?
Again, learning opportunity. we stated the vision, I would say, we could have been clear up front. So there was a lot of kind of pushing and pulling and continuous ideas throughout the process. They were great to work with. I would think on our future projects, and even we're doing this, we've done this on the Scoundrel, a big learning opportunity was being much clearer on the concept, the vision, and the narrative up front. Creating a mood board was the easy part, but really defining what the hotel concept was, what the brand stood for, what the F&B offerings were going to be, and giving the designers a better sense and understanding of this operationally, I think was one thing that we put a bigger focus on.
When did the branding come about? Because there's like two schools of thought. Some people like to work on the branding first before they hire anyone and really like help them create the vision. And other people bring it in at the end. What have you found to be the best approach?
We started with the brand. I think we'll continue to start with the brand. And I go back to what I was saying. It's very important. I mean, when you do a lifestyle hotel, you know this. There may be four, five, six different types of designs from architect, engineers, interior design, landscape design, lighting design, art, wayfinding. So to get all these different disciplines to really work together well, they need to have a good understanding. And to have a good understanding, I think that brand, the ethos, the narrative, what it stands for, what are the target and guest demographics, what they look like, that's what helps bring the vision to one for them to be able to go and execute on that. Without that, it's just a organized chaos. It's kind of our thought of how we go about the process, because no one really knows what the end goal is without that branding and concept clearly defined up front. And I think it's good for the design team because they always have a gospel or Bible to be able to refer back to. Am I making the right decision for what the way back is versus the last boutique hotel that I did? Is this the right decision for Paloma, which is the restaurant? Is this the right decision for the swim club? Because within the Wayback brand, there are multiple brands that you have to think for and account for and show them how the guest interaction with those spaces is going to be or how the overall brand architecture works among those. So I think that's very important. I think a lot of people make that mistake. They get directly into the, I like that wallpaper more than this wallpaper. That tile, I can't live without that tile. I don't believe the wallpaper, the tile, makes as much different as the experience in the brand and the cohesiveness. I mean, in this space, designers are so talented. They're going to make it look good. They're not going to design an ugly space. But to design a space that makes sense, that's well articulated, and when the guest comes in, they're going to know why it's there and what it is. That's where I think a lot of the secret sauce is, and that people that I would share with people when they're going about this is be very clear upfront about what the vision and the concept is.
Were you nervous about importing a design vocabulary and an inspiration, a vibe from California, Palm Springs to Pigeon Forge, Tennessee? Like, were you at all like worried that, oh, maybe these people aren't going to get it and we should go more like the Dolly World, you know, Pioneer vibe or something?
Absolutely. We heard that a lot. We were told that a lot. Pigeon Forge is this kitschy place that something higher end or sophisticated won't work in the market. But we need the market. I mean, the same people that came here, we get 15 million visitors per year in this market. And these same individuals are going to Nashville, Miami. New York is one of the, I think, top 10 markets where people are coming in from. So when they go back home, they're seeing these types of hotels. They're experiencing these types of hotels. But when they came to this market in the past, all they had was the select service hotels or the old mom and pops that we had to choose from. With this being our backyard, we knew the guest. We knew the market. We knew internally that this was the right move and that the market was ready. When we first moved into the market in 2005, there was almost no branded select service. it was really 90% independent mom and pops. The big select service names that you know with Hilton Marriott ISG started coming in 2008-07. And then from 2007 to when we started doing what we're doing, it was really just the mainstream brands.
Wow.
And we'd seen nearby markets like Asheville, North Carolina, Chattanooga's. Those go through this transition a decade before when we started it. So we knew that the region was getting ready for it. And post-COVID, everyone was moving to Tennessee. A lot of people were moving to Florida. So I think where they were moving from, the Californias, New Yorks, they were used to that. So I think it was the right time for the market, and we were very passionate about the space, and it made sense for us. And we felt good enough about it to take the risk on.
Looking back on your experience with the Wayback, if you were going to advise someone else who was trying to do what you did, and they were evaluating whether the bones and the location of the property were good enough or just right, what would you tell them to look out for and to think about?
The unknown. There's always going to be a lot of unknown, and having healthy contingencies in the budget. Definitely focus up front on getting a property condition assessment or some sort of, you can get the architects about how to get in and do testing through the hotel, through the electrical panels, plumbing, because you don't know really where you're going to be getting into and opening a wall. Every time we opened a wall, we saw something different and unknown. Every plan we had yep. got ripped up and thrown out the window every time something new got opened up. So especially with buildings post-1960s and 70s, it gets a bit easier, but the older the building get, the more dangerous or unknown it's going to be.
Yep.
I mean, we doubled the budget on the project from the time we broke ground to the time we opened. And it's stuff that most of the stuff is stuff that no one could have known. But by the time you demo 134 rooms, there's really no going back.
Where did you miss out? Like looking back on that project, what was something you missed on that you're not going to miss on a future project that you just didn't know, or you tried something and didn't work?
You know, I don't know about missing out. We are very happy with where the hotel is today. I would think one piece that made the world of difference and we'll probably spend double the money on future projects is landscaping. Typically, I've heard people, the first thing people will cut in VE is landscape. No need for this, no need for that. We on our next project have doubled the landscaping budget because of the impact it's made on this project. I mean, the first thing people do when they drive up is, wow, this is cool, this is neat. They get that feeling. And I think in experiential hotels, what they call boutique lifestyle experiential, landscaping is one of those things that goes so unnoticed or underappreciated by developers until you see it. I mean, you've done many projects, one or any of your Florida projects. I'm sure you guys spent a good amount of money on landscaping. I think that's what really helps visually set the property apart. I mean, you can only do so much with paint or specialty materials. Landscaping and that liveliness that you get from it, I mean, that's what can help activate the exterior and sometimes an interior of the property.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. Actually, I think we were connected by a landscape architect that we work with, Rios Clement Hale, RCH, out of LA, who's unbelievable. We worked with them on the One Hotel West Hollywood, and our landscape budget on that project was like astronomical compared to a lot of other projects. But now that project is known for that component of it, like the landscaping, people are taking selfies, and actually they have a restaurant tenant kind of in this courtyard that we created. And I think a lot of the success of that great restaurant, the restaurant's amazing, like it had an awesome reputation, but part of the drive to put people there is because they're in this beautiful setting surrounded by nature. And a lot of people cut it out, or a lot of people like get to the end of the project and run out of money and it gets kind of forcefully cut out. I actually like to, you know, put in the landscaping, see how it looks, but we always save money for like more landscaping to layer in, because if you have a really great landscape architect, like they typically get it, but most of them, it'll just never be enough landscaping and there'll just be big holes and it won't look right. And you have to have more money to do it and do it and do it.
Yep. So Nate did introduce us at Rios, and I am a huge fan of that firm. When he joined, I think Rios joined midway through the Scoundrel Design project, and we changed a lot of stuff around to be able to bring in these biophilic elements. I mean, we're doing this great hotel in the top national park of the country, and to not bring the outside in was a big miss. So the ideas that they brought, I think, are going to make the most impact on that future project, whether it's the hardscape, landscape, interior landscape, and any other fun ideas that they've come up with. And going back to your point, I was on site last week with a landscape designer for Wayback, layering in. Because you can only do so much up front. It comes in after about 6 to 8 months, then you go back and see, where did we miss? Yep. So we're spending a good chunk of change, some in the month of October, and then again in the spring, to layer in and really bring the full landscape to life. We did a small 36-room, 4-star property in Gatlinburg called the Rocky Waters. We spent about 2.5 years on the property renovating it. It's an old 1930s building that hangs over the river. The whole building is cantilevered over the river. Wow. I mean, you can't beat the setting. But every time someone drives by, the first thing they mention, the first thing, is not the copper fixtures on the building, not the black beautiful wood, or the cobblestone pavers we put in, it's the landscape. You guys did something so cool with the landscape, and that's something people notice it. And it makes a huge difference. It can make a huge difference if done correctly.
What does done correctly mean? Like, what are the key elements that you think have to exist to get the landscaping right?
I think landscaping is not just the look, it's how you interact with the space. So in our landscaping, we integrate 3 things. It's the landscape design, it's also landscape lighting, and the music within that. So we kind of bring all 3 together. At the Scoundrel, we're taking it a step further, is what's the FF&E in this landscape space going to feel and look like as well. So like anything else, it's a space, and it takes a lot of different creative vision and direction to make it a proper landscaped area. So whether it's different 100%. Colors, different elevations, different heights, I mean, they know their business better than I do, but I think what I've learned and what we've done is bring all these different collaborations and disciplines together in the design phase, because it can't just be one alone.
What I've really learned about in kind of the 3-4-star space is if you have like 3 levels of quality, you know, C being something that looks too cheap, B being something that probably looks pretty good, and A being something that looks outstanding. I found that you really only should go with the A in that level if the guest is going to like touch it, interact with it, feel it. Otherwise, a lot of the times it's fine to go with the B. And oftentimes people and designers over design things and drive budgets, and then you're forced to like cut out things that you probably shouldn't cut out because you're using too expensive of a material over here. How did you think about like being double the budget on the way back and making cuts in the right places and not the wrong places?
You know, we took the exact approach that you just said. If we take what we feel out of it as owners and developers, like I said, I can like a tile, the guests may not give two craps about what the tile is specifically, right? But we spend our money where the guest is going to be wowed when they arrive, touch it, feel it, can sense it. That's really where our focus is if it makes a guest impact, then it's worth the budget.
Coming from a very limited service background, at least on the family side, how did you approach food and beverage in your hotels, and why did you even want to have food and beverage?
I mean, we believe to do lifestyle experiential properly, food and beverage is a major component. To build a destination hotel where people come and stay and you don't want them to leave. I think for them to be able to eat, have drinks, enjoy it, be better with them with the place next door or at home, I think it's a non-starter. I don't think you can have a experiential property of any sort without food and beverage. I think that's what can help set the operation apart is great food and beverage. It was difficult. It's challenging. I can't name one operator that I've met that enjoys the food and beverage side of the business, the operation, but everyone takes notice to when food and beverage operation is done successfully with good results and good food. So I think we put a lot of time and effort into that. We learned a lot of lessons, can't take shortcuts in it. Tough business to be in, but it makes a huge impact on the guest.
Yeah, I think one of the things I've learned is I can probably identify 1 out of 10 amazing lifestyle hotels that don't have good food and beverage or that don't have food and beverage at all. And of the ones that I really like, 9 out of 10 has the food and beverage, whether they're making money or not on it. Maybe that's like the little, like the 1 out of 10 component. But of all the good lifestyle hotels, all of them do the food and beverage well. I think the difference is some will make a lot of money on it and some will not directly make money on the F&B, but it'll allow them to create this great hotel. And that was kind of what I was like trying to ask you before, where I've just seen a lot of hotel and hospitality concepts pop up without food and beverage. And it doesn't have to be like an elaborate, you know, 3-star meal, but I think it's very hard to create a loyal following and to have the connection with the guest without food and beverage. It's like a bed and breakfast without the breakfast, and it's just a bed and it's very transactional.
Yeah. You know, I think everyone knows you have to have good food and beverage to run a fun, unique, experiential property. I think everyone just knows it. I think where a lot of people get tripped or don't want to go into it is when they look at the pro forma. A lot of people just say food and beverage loses money. The food in it, it can, in most cases it does. We are breaking even on it. Some of our concepts are making money on it. But you can't, the project in many cases isn't going to make sense. You're not going to be able to achieve that reputation without it. So maybe you're losing money on the food and beverage. We're losing money on a lot of things. I mean, select service hotels, who's making money on the breakfast? They're losing money on the breakfast, but they still do it, right? I think it's people aren't looking at it from that lens. Is we do so much in hotels that you're losing money on, but what you're losing that money on is providing value for that guest that's coming to your hotel. And I think food and beverage in the lifestyle space is very similar to people. I mean, my father, he ran properties in the 80s that had no breakfast, and he loved it. And then at that time, a lot of people didn't want to build the newer brands that had the free breakfast because people ate way too much food, and they were going to lose their money. But today, it's a staple of that segment, right? I think food and beverage, the way we're talking about it, is a staple in the 3.5-4-star boutique space. I mean, I would say, yes, be very cognizant of the food and beverage operation, the cost, but don't let that be the factor for you to not do the business.
What are the tweaks and the refinements that you're making as you've now done a few of these lifestyle hotels to get it to be a real enhancement to the hotel? And like, what things maybe are you shedding or are you doing without?
So I think one thing we've learned and studied and enjoyed the most is I think a lot of times you don't want to build a huge space. You want to be able to build a space that's going to be impactful and energetic. you don't want to build this huge restaurant because you could make so much more revenue if you had 50 or 100 more seats in the restaurant, right? You want a space that when the guests walk in on a Wednesday night, you have the ability to create that same burst of energy that you do on a Friday night. And you can't do that in a space when you walk in, it's wide open. So whether it's separation of spaces, being able to close spaces down, open spaces up from indoor to outdoor and connect spaces, I think that is the programming of the space is very important, and not building more than you need. I think it's safer and better to go smaller than larger, because the thing that's going to kill the business is if you walk into a dead, low energy space. So that's what we look for, is how do we create a space that you're just going to feel energetic. It's going to make you tap your toe or tap your heel whenever you move in or sitting in the space.
I love that. And you're so right, because a lot of maybe older school operations people or hospitality people basically build restaurants like a parking garage or a parking lot at Best Buy on Christmas. You know, they build the restaurant for the one day of the month or the one day of the week that the whole hotel is going to empty out at the same time into the restaurant. But 99% of the time, you know, you only need a third of it or half of it. And they miss the whole vibe and energy side. I would 100% agree with you. And even in our branded hotels, I am pushing to shrink down all these spaces. And it's like, you know what? If we're pumping out such great food and creating a great experience where people have to wait, well, they have to wait in a normal restaurant anyway. So they'll just have to wait here. But that is a very important thing, because there's nothing worse going into a hotel restaurant when that thing looks dead and empty.
And honestly,
versus a little corner cafe that's
packed. Exactly. I mean, go with, people think about hotel restaurants, I think of it as restaurants. And I understand, I think people mix the two. You go to standalone restaurants in downtown DC or Miami, some of the hottest restaurants are going into existing spaces. The mistake we make as developers is, I have a fresh set of floor plans from the architect. I can actually build it bigger here. I have so much more space to play with. Some of my favorite restaurants I go to, the restaurateurs go into the space and figure it out. And whether it's workflows or where the kitchen is going to be or the beverage operation or the bar, they make it work. And it's shoulder to shoulder, elbow to elbow, and you just go with it. I mean, and I think that is what makes the restaurant so great. And if you overbuild the restaurant, of course, you'll lose money on it. It's better to underbuild, and I think maybe have less gross margin for a better overall experience for the concept.
What was it about Blackberry Farm that made you wanted to do these lifestyle design-oriented hotels as opposed to just keep doing what your family was doing, which is more commodity style hotels? Why did you want to do something different?
So Blackberry Farm, I never wanted to, and I don't ever think we'll try to recreate what they've done. I don't think we could, even if we tried. I mean, what they've done is legendary. What Blackberry did was open my eyes to what's out there. I had no idea what the lifestyle space was, what luxury hotels were for Blackberry. And once I kind of found out about it, looked at its competitors, and then up until 2 a.m., 3 a.m. at night, just web surfing and trying to see, wow, there's so much out there that we or I didn't know. And I am really good at the hotel operation. I know it inside and out. I can go in, fix a PTAC, clean a room, close the front office. I mean, we know that this is like the back of our hand, but we just weren't excited about the physical asset back then. But this gives an opportunity to take what we knew and do something different. And I've always enjoyed the creative side of everything, working with my hands. So it kind of allowed me to take what I already knew and merge it with this big passion that I had, which was creating, building. Learned a lot more about design, branding, and a lot of these other disciplines that we know today in the space through that. But I think that's what helps me, is taking the old school with the new school, as you said.
What did you learn from the construction side building houses or buildings at Blackberry Farm? Because for those that haven't been there, like the details are phenomenal. The construction materials are amazing. Everything seems just so dialed in. I'm really curious to know like what you learned and how you've translated that to some of the projects you're working on, which also kind of feel like they've been there for a little bit and kind of feel new, but kind of also feel like they harken back to another time.
I mean, what I learned at Blackberry was the devil was in the details. And it takes a lot of coordination to make it happen. I think that's where sitting in on those construction meetings, seeing 15 designers on the project, listening in on the OAC meetings, I was able to really digest how much coordination it took to build more of the custom homes or the cottages that were in planning phase for 6 months before they pulled the trigger on it. How not to overthink and use what's readily available to you to be able to build. You don't have to have the best of everything. I mean, you would think that Blackberry Farm uses the most expensive materials. They do, but they're very smart about, like you said, where do you spend the money? What is the guest going to care about? Where, how do you make the impact? And being able to listen to how they thought through that and made it work and bringing the parties together, collaboratively involved, but also creating the schedules, the checklists, the details, running different teams, getting people to a remote part of East Tennessee was very eye-opening. I was at Blackberry for about 3 months before I enrolled in grad school and then moved over to DC, but that 3 months learned a lot that allowed me to know what to look for and what to focus on when I was learning or then building my own company.
Some of your hotels are below 100 keys. How have you figured out how to make those hotels profitable? Because a lot of old school thinking is that, you know, 60 keys and under, you can't make any money. Blackberry Farm and Amon Giri have proved a lot of those people wrong, but how have you figured out how to do it?
We knew how to do it because most of our hotels were less than 60 keys and we ran them ourselves and they were very profitable. I'll take the Rocky Waters Motor, for example. The Rocky Waters is a 36 key old motel in downtown Gatlinburg. It was the first lodging establishment in Gatlinburg dating back to the 1930s. It was one small hut that the original owner built. He handed it down to his son, who then built a couple other small houses and then a second store on top of it and everything that hung over the river. So over the time, it became one of the most iconic locations and buildings in town. I mean, you can't go into Gatlinburg without going through the Rocky Waters. In the 1950s, Bud Lawson, who was the original owner, his mother, Maddie Lawson, had the tea room. But when he took the business over, he didn't want to be in the restaurant business. So he turned it into rooms. So when we thought about how do we take Rocky Waters into the 4-star, we know we can't do it without a wonderful food and beverage program. So we brought the restaurant back. Then the question became, how do we provide the 4-star experience with a 100-seat restaurant with 36 rooms? And the service level behind it with almost no back of house space. I mean, it's an operator's worst nightmare. But we knew the asset and we knew how to make it work. So at Rocky Waters, we have a concept that we call the innkeeper. And every room comes with a team of two dedicated innkeepers. When we ran the business, there was the lobby and our room behind it. And I can remember many winters where there was no business in town back in 2007, 2008, 2009. We would cover all three shifts, AM, PM, overnight, sleep behind the office. Next to the office was the laundry, did all the laundry, cleaned all 36 rooms, and then went to do the rooms on the backside if we had to as well. Maintenance, Dad did it. I would help him. I'd do the grounds. Deb would help with the front office and breakfast and everything else. So the three of us ran the entire property. And on the weekends, we'd fill up, but you can't go and hire staffers for the weekends. So we'd buckle down. So we really took what we knew, created operational training guides of how to do it. I mean, when we were doing that, the guests would come check in. And after day, they would say, wait, we thought you were the one checking us in. We were. Oh, now you're cleaning our room? Now you're bringing us toilet paper if we wanted to? I mean, you guys are doing everything. So we took the exact same ownership that we used to have. I mean, that we'd have is take ownership of the guest. We were the innkeepers of the property. So with the Rocky Waters, we kind of brought that back and brought the staff in and trained them on how to take full ownership of the guest experience. So that's what the model that we used for that hotel, and it's been phenomenal. Guests still check in and will ask Claudia or Kaylee or anyone else, wait, I thought you checked us in. You're also doing X, Y, and Z now as well. So I think with creativity, training, nurturing that, and just working with your teams, it can be done. But again, it takes a lot of high touch, and the technology piece makes a big difference as well. In today's day and age, with the technology done properly, it can have a huge impact. I think I've seen a couple of the other podcasts that you've done with some of the individuals doing smaller micro resorts. There's a huge emphasis on technology. So we still put a massive emphasis on technology. I mean, I can't tell you, Dev, my brother, he probably went through 30 or 40 different vendors across locks or PMS or POS, booking engine, to see what is the best technology stack going to be to enable our team to not be caught up in the administrative side, but the guest-facing side. So the hotel has no front desk, but the guest does their pre-check with the guest questionnaire prior to arrival, gets a PIN code before they arrive with the code to the room. So what our staff is doing is the payment's been taken before they get there. They've got the access to the room. So we're taking them, welcoming them to the property and taking them up to the room. So a lot of conversations in the industry has been, can there be hotels without the front desk? And I think the conversation gets mixed in technology and guest service. I think guest service is critical, but if we use technology properly, we can take some of the friction points out for the staff to be able to focus on the high impact areas in the guest journey.
Can you unpack the Rocky Waters a little bit more? So like, if you don't have a front desk and you said like there's this innkeeper concept, like, so how does that work? Like the folks there do multiple jobs. Like how does it play out in reality? Because for those that don't know, like it's a small leading hotel of the world, right?
A small luxury hotel of the world. Yep.
Small luxury hotel of the world. So it's a real hotel. So can you kind of like, how does it like unpack it a little bit more? Because it's really cool.
So we focus a lot on the guest journey, and we use the term guest journey to map out what is the guest experience going to be from the time they find your hotel online to the time they check out and take a survey. So everything between those two endpoints, we create and see how is that going to operationally flow. So I can walk you through it in detail, and feel free to ask any questions where you want along the way. So yeah. When a guest makes a reservation, the first thing they get is a questionnaire. What are their stay preferences? What are they coming to town for? It's couples only. So which makes it a bit easier. But what are they coming for? What type of food do they like? Red wine, white wine, sparkling beverages. What do they have interest in doing when they come to Gatlinburg? Is it the national park? Is it the mountains? Is it hiking, river rafting? Or do they just want to come and unwind and relax? So it's a list of 15 to 20 questions that allows our team of innkeepers to understand the guest profile. So each room has a team of two dedicated innkeepers. So by the time they're coming to Gatlinburg, our team knows exactly what they're coming for. We'll call them and get to know them and see if there's anything else we can do. when they're coming, typically, I think it's 2 days before, we take care of method of payment, ID, and guest room access all electronically. Gate access, all done electronically. So when they're coming in.
So what platform do you use to manage that whole thing?
Remote Locks is what we use for the lock systems. We use this PMS called Stay in Touch. And there's a couple of other ones. That's, I think, above my pay grade. My brother's the tech guy. I like pen and paper. But there's a five or six systems that he's created or worked with the GMs and our operations team to put in place to be able to get them to all talk together and integrate and do all of the stuff that the technology needs to do.
So 2 days before, I'm getting this information with the gate code, the access to the room, and then like I roll up to the gate, what happens?
The gate opens, so we know roughly what time the guest is coming in. Morning of, we're texting the guests. Hey, are you still on time, Jake? Mr. Warzak for 4 p.m. today. Absolutely. So we have a list of what time each guest is coming in by. We know they're making Marlo the car. So the guest knows Jake is coming in a white Range Rover. So when they pull in, they know exactly what to expect. The room has been assigned. We show them the parking space and welcome them to the Rocky Waters and take them directly up to the room and show them everything that they need to know about the property. If they let us know they have any experiences that they want to do or excursions, we've got their information waiting for them. Each room has a mini bar of 4 high-end bourbons and whiskeys and different stuff in the room for the guests to enjoy as well, on the river, robes, you name it. So the guest has access to all that information while they're there. And when they're there, we don't have our keepers hovering over them. We are there when the guest needs us as quickly as the guest needs us. So everything is text message enabled. So if you need me, you can call me, you can text me, or you can open the door. And if you see me outside, let me know what you need me to do. But we're there for you. If you want me to check in with you more periodically, we'll do it. If you say we'd like to be just left to ourselves and alone and relax, we'll do that as well. So those same innkeepers are greeting the guests at the hotel. They're cleaning the rooms. They're doing room service, taking care of grounds and the building, whatever the guest needs. I mean, there's not one thing that our team of innkeepers doesn't do for the guest.
Is it harder to find, you know, that person because they're doing so many different things? Like, you know, a front desk person, okay, they're just checking someone in at the front desk. But now you got to find someone willing to be a concierge, willing to clean a room, and willing to rake leaves. Has that been a challenge? Or do you find that like you're actually getting kind of more entrepreneurial, old school innkeeper people, and they're just better and you found them?
You know, I don't know if it's the area that we're in, or if you go into the country and this could work. We found wonderful people that just want to come and take care of a guest and do what's needed. We haven't found that much friction from our staff to say, no, I don't want to do this, or this is above me. I think when they see the property, when they themselves come and experience it, when we show them what the guest journey is, the first thing we get is excitement. And when they put a smile on the guest's face, I think when they get that question, oh, you do this too? I think they love saying, yes, I'll do anything for you that you need me to. And I think it's made a huge difference on that property's guest experience, but also, as I'm sure you know, the profitability.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're describing really the future of, call it luxury-ish hospitality, where you're providing everything that 95% of the guests want at the level that they want it, but not providing it for the 5% that want a 6 or 7-star experience that then blows out your whole P&L. And you're focusing on the most interesting aspects. So
yeah, and I mean, interesting. A bit deeper in that, I mean, you know, the question that you asked, I think a lot of people asked us when we talked about it, was how can you get someone to do the front desk check-in and running the credit cards, but also that person to clean the rooms? Well, with the technology, we've taken the administrative process out of it. We've got one person that's taking care of all of that prior to the guests coming And the technology works so well together that it's the click of a few buttons to be able to charge the card, have them take a picture of the ID, and fill out a questionnaire. Other than that, what else is the check-in process going to be? So we still give them the warm welcome as you would receive at a typical hotel with someone behind the front desk. But the technical work hasn't been taken out of it. So the guest doesn't have to deal with it when they check in, nor does the staff when they're on property. So they can just focus on the guests and their needs.
So you've got a 36-room hotel. How did you think about the F&B so that it's just right, not too much, not too little, focusing on outside guests, maybe, I don't know. Like, talk me through that process.
So the restaurant at Rocky Waters is the heirloom room, and it's a family heirloom that's been handed down from generation to generation in Appalachia. So it's really higher-end Appalachian cuisine. And it is, luckily, it was in a small building, and we didn't get to design it from scratch. That made us work within the box, keep it small, keep it intimate, and work with the character that the building had. So I talked a little bit about the gate. The rooms portion of the inn is walled off by about 300 feet of landscape, stone wall, and this black wood cladding. And then it's gated entry. The restaurant is right on the street with maximum visibility. When people drive into Gatlinburg, I mean, that restaurant's getting 15 million cars every year. Everyone's going to know exactly where the restaurant's at. When they see, wow, this place looks incredible, I've got to try this place out. So I think we use the different landscape design elements to give some exclusivity to the rooms portion, but then bring out the restaurant side that we want to have access for the guests, but it'll also be the place in town for people to want to go. So it's been great. I mean, it has been wildly successful this first 60 days. And anytime you go there, it's pretty busy because the space can't be cut down when on the weekdays, it'll feel as busy as it is on the weekends. And on the outside, the whole building is cantilevered over the river. So the outdoor patio hangs over the river. So while you have the property 15 feet away from the road with all this vehicular traffic, when you're on this side of the building, all you hear is that water rushing. So it's really the space that you just don't even feel like you're in downtown Gatlinburg. We've turned it into its on the water mountain restaurant that you can't, it's a place of its own.
Thinking 5 years from now, where do you want to be? What do you want to be doing?
I want to stay excited as I am today about the business. We want to grow, but I don't think we want to grow too quick. We like this approach where we've been doing 2-3 hotels a year, but really doing hotels that excite us. We never say never, but I don't think we'll turn into the operator that's doing 10-12 hotels or developers that are in 10 to hotels a year. We like the 2-3. We are going to continue to grow our select service tract of the business, but also the lifestyle tract of the business. And what we're doing, I think select service even will be focusing on enhanced select service versus a typical hotel on the side of an interstate. And getting better day by day, whether we bring in construction in-house or we don't, hospitality is at the center of our business. And I think we do it differently. We try to do it differently and just get better day by day.
I ask all the guests on the podcast the same closing question. And that is, what's your favorite hotel out of all the places you've been or seen?
Without a doubt, we've talked about it 5 times on this podcast, Blackberry Farm. I'm not looking to go somewhere 1,000 miles away from me. There's this wonderful place in my backyard that's always doing fun, unique stuff. I haven't been to Blackberry Mountain yet, but I really want to check it out. The pictures you posted, was it a water slide you were on or what was that?
Yeah, they built a water slide like into this lake and it's kind of coming down the side of a mountain. So it's pretty wild and it's a lot of fun. It's actually very like steep and fast. So I think it's only kind of like a summer-ish thing, but incredibly creative to basically activate this pond.
I've been to the farm. I really want to check out the mountain. And I'm sure they'll do stuff in the future, which is always the treat.
For those that don't know, like, what would surprise people most about Blackberry Farm?
I think they've done a phenomenal job of creating their talent. It is the level of service that they provide. I mean, I go to any 4 or 5-star hotel, and the staff they've recruited from all over the world. I mean, literally all over the world. I was in a St. Regis in Punta Cana. No, where was it? Punta de Mita in Mexico. And I probably staff from 10 different countries, especially the management, right? They brought them in from everywhere. Blackberry Farm, they've done so well at the people and culture side of the business. Most people are East Tennessee based, and most people are from that county or surrounding counties. So I think a lot of companies will bring in talent, but what they've done with the talent pool and nurtured them and grown them is unbelievable. And it's still hard to believe how they've not had to go into different markets to build that talent pool. And I'm sure you see the same thing when you go to resorts when you're traveling.
I love that answer. Hire for the person, not for the job in hospitality, because 99% of the things in hospitality can be trained, but you cannot train that kind of innate graciousness and wanting to help and serve people. And it's pretty cool to see this at Blackberry Farm or Mountain, because Mavir's right. Everyone there is like from Tennessee. They like live 20 minutes down the road.
Exactly. And they treat it like their home. So they're welcoming to
you. Treat it like their home.
Exactly.
Amazing. Thanks for coming on the podcast. This was a lot of fun. You did great.
Thanks for having me, Jake.
Hey, everyone. It's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.